think there's babies in the room.
David, would you like to introduce your sister?
You're looking to me to introduce Hazel Ruby Copthorne. Was born last Thursday at 8:44, 5 pounds 8 ounces, 18 inches. We left the hospital in less than 24 hours, which is what we wanted to do. And we're busy, but enjoying her beauty. And I'm pleased to bring her to introduce, proud to show her off.
Thank you to Mark and Diana and David, and welcome Hazel Ruby. Sort of changes the energy in here, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, it's Kitzendo. It's really Kitzendo. It just coming in and seeing her made me remember when my daughter was big enough, was no bigger than you could hold in a hand. You know, and now she's in college. This tends to happen. It's called growing up, or something like it. I saw a t-shirt at the gym the other day. The t-shirt said, growing old is inevitable, growing up is optional. So, I wanted to ask the kids a few questions. Do you see me as a grown-up?
Yes.
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 I was afraid of. Well, you know, I'm still wondering what I'm going to be when I grow up. When I was, let's see, Mira, how old are you?
Nine.
And David?
Eight.
Yeah, when I was about your age, I was very interested in medicine. I wanted to be a kind of a research scientist doctor. And my grandfather worked in a hospital, and I had a really good, I had this great microscope that I had inherited from my stepfather. It was really, really, actually I still have it. And I don't know what to do with it. It's very cool. You know, it's like, anyway. So my grandfather got me all of these slides from the laboratory there. He had like slides of, you know, like tissue samples and blood and all this stuff. And I really liked looking at it in the microscope. And I was, at the time, probably the world's youngest expert on hematology. That was a study of the blood. I actually knew a lot about it, you know, all of which I've forgotten, but I was fascinated by looking at these cells and thinking about all this stuff, and I thought, oh, well, that's what I may do when I, that's what I'll do, I was pretty sure, when I grow up. That lasted about 2 years. I'm still wondering. So, I never dreamed. Did you ever want to be? Well, I'm curious. What would you like to be when you grow up? Do you know? Do you have any idea?
I want to be a photographer.
A photographer? What kind of photography?
Someone who takes photography of nature.
Photography of nature? Do you do that now? Well, you could start.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. David, you know what you want to do?
No.
Childcare.
Do you have any ideas? Do you ever think about it? Do you have fantasies?
Yeah, I have only two. One is basically helping animals and saving them. The other one is designing video games.
Those are highly compatible. If you could teach the animals how to play the video games, then you could do both of them. Think how happy they would be. Leo, what about you?
I don't really know, but I think I'd like to make some trails out in the wild. Or maybe make some parks for the animals. Uh-huh. Reserve parks for only animals.
That's cool. Do you guys spend a lot of time outdoors?
Yeah.
That's great. Does anyone want to be a Zen priest?
No, not really.
You know, it's pretty good.
No.
It's kind of like being a fireman, except there's no truck.
No, thank you. Never. Absolutely never.
Yes, the wisdom of youth. Well, that's good. Those are great ambitions. And what do you imagine your sister be?
I don't know, maybe a chef.
A chef? You don't think she's going to be a nature photographer?
I think she's actually going to be a chef.
Do you cook at home?
No.
Why do you think she's going to be a chef?
I don't know. She just drew a picture of a chef.
Uh-huh. Okay. And do you have any ideas what you might...
No.
No. It's a little early, isn't it? And she's not capable of answering for herself yet. Not like the baby Buddha who, when the baby Buddha was born, was a little precocious. You know, he took 10 steps in each direction. And it's like not usual, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, this is very interesting, and if you have any ideas of maybe you can tell me after, if you have any ideas of what I should be when I grow up, I'm still open.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you. It's Leo's. You can. That's really something. It's just it's a complete miracle to me how this life blossoms forth and occurs again and again. And to think also, to look around this room, that every one of us was like that at one point. We were all so cute. What happened? You're still cute.
We're
still like that. Well, that's... So I thought I would talk a little bit about growing up today, and sort of speculate about it. What I think it means, what it means within the context of our practice. I was listening... Did anyone hear much of the Sotomayor hearings? Yeah, I was listening to it really intensively. Aside from, I'm not going to get into the politics of it, because there's something quite reprehensible about it, I think. But there was a wonderful exchange between Al Franken and Sonia Sotomayor, where he got into asking her why she had become a lawyer, and she said, "Well, when I was in child, we used to sit around the TV and watch Perry Mason." And he said, "Oh, I did that too." And what was interesting was what inspired her it inspired her to be a prosecutor. I think that's really strange, actually. It's like if you take Hamilton Burger as your role model. But anyway, it did.
Maybe she thought she could do a better job.
Yeah, I think that. given the sort of the cast and character of her mind, she may have felt I could beat Perry Mason. You know, maybe I think that's good. But you know what we resonate with as a child, what we resonate with as an adult is very, to me, it's quite mysterious and wonderful, and how we are challenged to hold on to that wide open spirit as which is a spirit of beginner's mind. You know, in beginner's mind, there are many possibilities, and then as our life goes down this railroad track, we often feel these possibilities are they're kind of shaved away by our responsibilities, by the particular situation we find ourselves in, by our jobs, and yet at heart, I think we want that child to still be alive in us. I think that's really important to maintain some childlike quality. So I was quite moved by that. And thinking about Kid Zendo, thinking about these two aspects of this question, you know, what do you want to do when you grow up? And perhaps not quite the identical question of what do you want to be when you grow up? Which is sort of how you view what does maturity mean to you or mean to me, and how does it manifest in the world? I think that these are both matters contained within the field of practice. I still don't know what I want to be. I actually often think this, I still don't know what I want to be when I grow up. It's not quite a joke. And maybe that's not so much childlike as childish of me. But while I still wonder about this stuff and speculate, I seem to have settled into a variety of roles. I'm a father, and now I'm a father contemplating in a few years the departure of my children. One of them has already gone off, which is kind of amazing to imagine. I'm a priest, I'm a musician, an activist, a writer, you know, and I live a life of multitasking. Actually, this is a really bad model for a Zen teacher or student. We're supposed to do one thing completely. So, I'm sorry. This seems to be my life. But that doesn't, I'm not sure that interferes with growing up. Certainly, you know, I can't say for myself, and I'm not going to ask you whether you think I'm grown up or not. I'm sort of slightly afraid of what the answers would be. But, you know, if I look at Sojin Roshi, who is now 80. And when you look at him, I think, when I look at him anyway, I can still see the boy there. And, you know, in contact with each of us as we're talking, we can still see this kernel of the child who really wants to be open to the whole world and take it in. This is my sense of what it means to be alive. And from time to time you meet people, every now and then you meet people where you have a really hard time seeing that within them, which is kind of sad. It may be a shortcoming of one's own, of my vision or one's own vision, but sometimes life just kind of wrings the child out of the person. But I think that the practice that we're doing encourages its life. You know, it encourages its life in the context of beginner's mind. And I will say that all of us have met in our days some people that we consider pretty awake, whether we're going to call them enlightened or realized or, you know, whatever, the people who are really awake in the world. And when I've had the opportunity of the people that I've met who I felt that about, there's no kind of strict evaluative standard for this, but they all have this kind of lightness and often humor and flexibility and joy. Thinking some of you will get to meet, if you haven't met, a lot of you have met Hoitsu Suzuki. He's got it, right? You know, and it really transmits it. The joy that he has is just kind of contagious. You catch it. And you can see the little boy in the man who's nearly 70 now, and they don't conflict with each other. I think there's what I see as maturity, and I've thought this for quite a while, is I try to be serious about the things that I do. You know, I take them seriously and attentively. And yet I think that the notion of our understanding of Dharma means that we don't take ourself very seriously. We carry ourself lightly. I think it's when we have all these reasons for it, there's a kind of dharmic deconstruction of the self, which proves ipso facto that the self cannot be precisely identified or pointed to. You break it down into these different elements, the skandhas, and these different systems. But really, the manifestation of realization, I think, is just being light about oneself, which means being flexible. And I think that when I first came here, about 25 years ago, and there were people that I looked up to, and I couldn't even name it what it was, but they seemed, I didn't feel like a child. I felt like stuck in the middle, you know. I was about 35 years old, and I was, you know, it's like half of me was about age 13, and the other half was like about 70, you know. And the people that I met, 70 in a bad way, the people that I met here, and actually there's one sitting right there, Ron, and others, they had that quality. And those of you who know Ron and know people who've been around here a long time, they have that quality. They're very serious and attentive to what they do, and yet there's a kind of lightness. And I I saw this in Sojin, but I saw it in wherever I went in the Zen world. I saw people like that, and where that was really encouraging. I wanted to be like that. I didn't particularly want to smell very Zen-y, which was had a caricature of kind of this over seriousness and fierceness. Is this light quality that spoke to me. That, in an intuitive sense, seemed to me a really good standard, a really good model for maturity, for growing up. So, I think there are a couple of elements that I see as creating this, that arise in our practice and arise in our zazen. Suzuki Roshi talks a lot about composure. And it's a very important word for him. And Sojin talks about also keeping your composure. Suzuki Roshi, in one of his lectures, he says, this is interesting, to attain enlightenment means to have this kind of complete composure in our life, without any discrimination. And then he says, but at the same time, without any discrimination, meaning we accept everything as it comes, without it, without judging whether it's good, bad, right, wrong. And then in his typical way, he says, but at the same time, if we stick to this attitude of non-discrimination, that is also a kind of discrimination, you know. So in other words, if we're caught in this place of not making distinctions, of not being able to evaluate, if we hold that, we hold too tightly to that as a principle or as a measuring stick, then we are discriminating in a really hazardous way. So, at the same time, if we stick to this kind of attitude of non-discrimination, that's also a kind of discrimination, you know. So how we practice Zazen, how we attain this kind of complete composure, is the point. This is the point. This is what we're constantly working with as we sit. Sojin talked about this a couple weeks ago. I forget whether it was on a Monday or a lecture. And I think it was a very unique and personal kind of way of framing it. I talked to him about it afterwards because I never heard it quite put this way. So we're always talking about the relative and the absolute, right? This is a big conundrum, and it often comes up in lectures. This is also what we know as the two truths. So the truth of the absolute, of things exactly as they are, and the truth of the relative, how they manifest in the world. Sojin Roshi put it a different way. Someone may remember the context. I thought this was really interesting. So this is his framing of two truths. Is the first truth is the truth of reality just as it is. This is the realm of non-discrimination. And the second truth, or the other truth, we're not ranking these, right? The other truth is the truth of your feelings about reality. That's not a conventional way to frame that, but I thought it was really useful. We all have, that's a truth, that whatever comes up in the world, whatever comes up in our lives, whatever we experience, whatever we perceive, we have some feelings about it. In using feelings not in a technical way, just in a very broad way. We may like, dislike, we may feel drawn to it, we may feel repelled, we may think, you know, anywhere in between, there are all these elements, you know, like and dislike sometimes are not so clear, and maybe our feelings are not so clear. So, the practice that we are cultivating as we sit is sitting in the middle of those two realities, which is something that is, on the one hand, almost inexpressible or inexpressible. On the other hand, it's what we're doing all the time. We're making an effort to see things as they are. We make an effort to accept, go back to the Sotomayor hearings, to accept things are they as they are, is there's a universe in which there is Sonia Sotomayor and Jeff Sessions, and that both of these are co-constructing reality, and what we're hearing on the radio or watching on TV is just the arising of reality exactly as it is. And yet we also have some feelings about this. Depending upon your conditioning, you may agree more with one side than another. And then, out of those feelings, in the world, we have to do something, or we may choose not to, which is also doing something. So, I think, as I've talked about before, I really like the koan of the title of the first two books by Katagiri Roshi. His first book was Returning to Silence. That's going to the truth of the reality of things as they are. His second book was called You Have to Say Something. So you have to say something in response to the truth of your feelings about how things are. So this is the conundrum of practice, and I sit in the middle of that all the time. I don't have this perfectly concentrated blissful zazen in which I'm just sort of coursing in some transcendent realm. It's like sometimes my mind is very busy. Sometimes things just take shape there. It's a very interesting, it's a very interesting kind of activity to accept it as it is, and then also to be checking your posture, checking your breath, to be readjusting all the time. So this is composure, I think, means finding your balance over and over again, finding your balance moment by moment. So I think this is, when we talk about growing up, we think about sort of the wide field of becoming mature, theoretically, but in the context of Zen, what does it mean to grow up moment by moment? Moment by moment, to be born, to be a child no bigger than Hazel Ruby, and to move through that through the life of that being in that moment, until that being and that moment pass away and the next one comes forth. Right within that, we grow up. Can we, and the challenge is, do we accept it or do we really not like it? Some people don't like it. Some people, a lot of people, are not going to be able to sit still because it's too uncomfortable to encounter oneself that way. But it's what we do. So this composure is one thing, and it's linked to what we might call control, what you might call your ability to endure. And so there's this, you know, this fairly famous section in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, in the control chapter, Suzuki Roshi says, the best way to control people is to encourage them to be mischievous. You know, well, that's, seems like to encourage play, to encourage the child. So to encourage them to be mischievous. Then they will be in control in the wider sense. To give your sheep or cow a large, spacious meadow is the way to control him or her. To give them the space to wander and play. So it is with people. So talking about our social world, but also talking about how we are, I mean, primarily talking about how we are with ourselves. Can you give yourself a wide field? Can you be really generous and allow that playful spirit to arise in yourself? Can you allow that moment by moment as you breathe? So he says, so it is with people. First, let them do what they want. So in other words, don't create a lot of rules, but see what they want to do. And first, let them do what they want and watch them. This is the best policy. To ignore them is not good. That's the worst policy. So, in other words, not to be kind of clueless, to be inattentive to what you are doing, speaking about oneself, quite aside from the social dimension. That's the worst policy. The second worst, he says, is trying to control them. The best one is to watch them. Just to watch them without trying to control them. So this is, here he's bringing up the non-discriminating side. And I think he's probably bringing it up because, you know, each of these teachings is a kind of medicine. And, you know, what he sees, particularly if we take up this somewhat formal practice of Zen, is we're always trying to control things. We're trying to get them to take a certain form or a certain shape, and so the first thing is to do is just watch, you know. And then he says the same way works for yourself as well. If you want to obtain perfect calmness in your zazen, you should not be bothered by the various images you find in your mind. That means the really dark and scary ones, the ones that are blissful and we want never to end. We find them and they find us, they arise in our mind. So not to be bothered by them, just to let them come and let them go. Then they will be under control, he says. So I think this is actually Zazen instruction. This is instruction in Shikantaza, to let whatever arises in your mind come up, let it have its natural lifespan, let it go, and to be able to endure that, whether it's, you know, incredibly difficult or blissful, is to find this composure, to have that capacity simultaneously. To be mature, I think, means simultaneously to be able to play, to be mischievous, to give yourself this wide field, and at the same time to be able to watch and accept whatever comes up. You know, he doesn't get, in this passage, he doesn't get to the stage in which there's a field. He said, to give your horse, your sheep or cow, a large, spacious meadow. that meadow has a fence around it. It has some boundaries. And to work with those boundaries is also what we're doing. We work within a form. We work within a shape of practice. We work within the myriad, sometimes very difficult forms of our life, our job, our family, our body, our thoughts. To accept, the question is, how do we play? How do we stay alive? How do we stay childlike without being childish? In other words, not to fall back into a state where we're having, you know, a tantrum, or we're caught, or we've re-stimulated the five-year-old boy in me that, you know, wonders where his father is and where his mother is, that's frightened. But to bring forth the childlike quality of which is beginner's mind. I think I'm going to stop there. There's more I could say, but I think I'll stop there, and I'm going to take about 5 minutes for questions, then I'll. So, Ron.
I was glad to hear you mention Sojin's talk, which I wasn't here for, about reality and feelings about reality, because several years ago during Shosan ceremony, I asked him, what's your feeling about the word emptiness? He said, I don't have a feeling about the word emptiness, it's just emptiness.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad, I think that he, and I felt, I didn't really, I felt something was lacking
mm-hmm.
in his answer. So I'm glad that he shifted what he said, or that he's seeing it from the, well, in this context at least, he could see some different way of looking at that.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. It really struck me when I heard it, as he's less given to talk about feelings than I am. But it was very clear, and I sort of asked him further about it, and I think that's a really interesting way of framing the two truths. It's useful, it's practical, rather than this kind of abstraction of relative and absolute, which kind of we get tangled up. So thank you. All the grown-ups. Oh, Ron!
I just tried to be polite. The second one is, there's this case in the Book of Serenity, Daizon's closest, nearness,
yeah.
That not knowing, that won't go to the whole case, but the punchline is not knowing is nearest. And part of the commentary goes on later in the commentary in that case. One of the old teachers, so and so, said that when you're affirming something or being positive, just totally be positive, but don't settle down there. And when you're being negative, just be negative, but don't settle down there. And I think that's kind of what Suzuki Roshi was saying about. Non-discrimination.
Yeah.
Don't settle down.
There. Right. As soon as you settle down someplace, then you've sort of staked out a claim on that place, the claim of self there, and of right, you know, of rightness or righteousness. So, yeah. So.
This childlike openness. Can you talk a little about is there a connection between that and one's face before one's
room? No, I can't talk about that. The whole universe is playing. The whole universe is constantly unfolding in the realm of total interaction. If we remember that, it allows us to be free. And I think this goes to what Ron was just saying. As soon as we settle down and think that the universe is a particular set of cause and effect that is going continuously to unfold in one way, then we have eliminated this element, which Suzuki Roshi says, best thing is to let them be mischievous. So if we allow the universe, which is our, which you could see as your face before you were born, to play, then, and we recognize that we are the universe, then we're free to move that way. One more.
I saw the film you were presenting to Berkeley, you know, the Burma film.
Yes.
I was just wondering if that, you know, horrendous situations that were shown and that we know about, do you actually regard them as mischievous play of the universe or something like that? Is that play or what is that?
So what she's talking about is this film Burma Vijay, which is a quite amazing film about the uprising in Burma in September 2007.
Or any situation of very brutal suffering.
Well, I think, you know, not to get too far out here, I think what was really amazing about that film was that they were playing. The people in the making of the film was so much about playing with this actually really difficult reality in such a way that it draws you in. So that's not justifying. There is evil. I don't have any question about that. People do terrible things to each other. That's a problem that will always be with us. So I don't have an answer to that. And I don't see things, because I'm human, I'm not capable of seeing things from the standpoint of the universe. So I don't evaluate it from the standpoint of the universe. I have to evaluate from the standpoint of my human awareness and consciousness, and so I hurt. Hurt is part of the reality of things.
When you say that's what the universe is doing, the universe is at play. Are you just...
Maybe you say the universe is in play.
Is that a statement from the point of view of the universe?
As close as I can get to it. Yeah. Because I can't really do that. And words do not suffice. And the moral questions endure, and they are they're very fierce and challenging to us. But how can I be light in the middle of that? That's actually partly what you see in that film. You see some hint of it from watching the monks. And I find that...
And also the guys.
Right, the guys in the camp. That's why I said, yeah. And so, they're playing with reality. So this is kind of inspiring, even though it does not have a happy ending yet. Okay, last one. We really have to end.
Well, I'm really reminded of something I read. I'm drawing a blank on the writer, but he writes about childhood. And he said that play and prayer are actually very nearly the same stuff. And play isn't necessarily all light and cheerful. Kids play with their fears,
right?
Play out their fears, conflict, aggression. It's a way of being with
sometimes very troubling, stuck in a creative,
yes,
exploratory mind that lets the feelings flow, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral,
right,
keep going.
Thank you. That's a really good place to end.